And this is Razor Shoutbreak. I'm with Sharon Firebrace. I've got with me right now Gerrit Sherrell Halufka, and he is the guardian of the Office of the Guardian. Welcome on board, Gerrit.
Sharon, thank you for having me, and of course also to the listeners for being aboard with our current interview.
Yes, indeed. Let's look at it. We've got Parliament reconvening at the end of the month. That's at the end of August. The big concern is not just Parliament itself reconvening, the fact that we've been through a double dissolution election. And we've got a top house, which is the Senate, which will be very difficult, I think, for the government to control. That's one element. And we've got a government that's now been returned back. That's a Turnbull government by the skin of their teeth, Gerrit. So this is going to be a government that's obviously almost a hung parliament. And we've also got here a statement by the Australian public who hit the polls recently and more or less outcast the Turnbull government, who won by a massive landslide just 3 years previously. And we're seeing that there's a turn from the major parties, and we're seeing now crossbenches, and we're seeing portional parties, and we're seeing minor parties. How would you interpret that political process? What are the public saying to you?
Well, first of all, I can't see that we give a mandate to Malcolm Turnbull as he claims he had, because an election doesn't work that way. When you have a referendum, that's what you call that you give a mandate, but not to an election, because the way the election runs is that Malcolm Turnbull, if he, let's say, had 55 seats, he obviously didn't get a majority 76. So what he does, he said, well, to the National Party, let's get together and we make some kind of agreement, and we do it in secret, which is preventing people to know the truth. And then he achieved 76. But that is not a mandate, because a mandate you can only get if you get majority of votes, of primary votes. So that to me is a concern. He is playing with figures to suit himself.
Yes, indeed. So, I mean, it's primary votes, and it's an attempt to get the majority, but he certainly didn't get the majority, because we see that he couldn't have even formed government without the compliance agreement and the cracking deals between the Liberals and the National Parties in order to be able to win government or make government or form government. So does that not also raise the issue and the concern about the sale of office? The Sale of Office Act of 1551, are they not selling the office in order to get the National Party's cooperation so they can hold government?
Well, my view is that, for instance, with Joe Hockey, when everybody was talking about that he was going to be the next ambassador to the United States of America while he was still in Parliament, well, to me, that stinks and reeks to the breaches of the Sale of Office Act. Now, which is a legislation that was introduced in England in 1551 to prevent this kind of a nonsense. The point is this, the Commonwealth must provide equal opportunity for laws. It cannot say, well, employers and unions must all conform to a certain agenda, but when it comes to ourselves, we can give, jobs to the boys. And when you look at Joe Hockey, couldn't even get his budget through the Parliament in 2014. He should have resigned there and then, and they should have had a double dissolution then. That didn't happen. And what you have is now that we will have plenty of very competent people in our society who are more than qualified to be ambassadors, but they don't get an opportunity because a person like Joe Hockey and other former politicians, they get the job. They don't have to apply. They get the job given to them. And why? Well, if you leave Parliament, if you make a vacancy for one of our friends, then we give you a nice job. Now, that is precisely what the Sale of Office Act 1551 was trying to prevent.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously they're breaking the rules, they're breaking the laws. Sale of Office Act, but I mean, how do we trigger it? I mean, obviously they're not going to. They need an outside external body to trigger it upon them and to bring them to trial so that we see justice here. What would you recommend as the appropriate mechanism to do that?
Well, first of all, what I would recommend is that we have a minimum 5 years, but preferable 10 years, that if a politician has been in Parliament, then the politician cannot go into a position that normally was associated with if he was a minister in Parliament or if he was a member of a committee in that field. Because what we had, for instance, with the former Defence Minister Peter Tariq, he was defence minister, and as I understand it, he resigned or got kicked out. And then he went working as a defence for a defence contractor. Now, he had all the internal knowledge of that. That, to me, is very serious. So what we need to do is make sure that, one, there is a proper formula in place that if a job vacancy comes up, whether it's being for an ambassador or whatever, that the person has to apply for it. If you don't apply for it, you can't get the job. So if there was a job like ambassador available, then there should have been an application for it, and everybody can apply to it equally on their qualifications, proving whether they are suitable or not. That is what I think it is. So a ban of 5 or 10 years for any particular position within the field that you were in government, and also a proper format of application.
Yes, indeed. So, I mean, that's for those that are already in government and parliament. But, you know, in the hockey situation, I mean, as you're saying, I mean, he should have really been sacked and terminated because he was a failed minister and he was a failed treasurer for the nation, as you said, because he could not get through the budget. So, if his budget failed, then he should have been terminated. But that very same budget also sits before us. And that is the budget that should have been approved before the federal election. That is the 2016 election that we've had just recently. There was no budget that was approved. It's a bit like running an association incorporation group or committee. You know, before you have an AGM, an annual general meeting, which is like an election. You need to have at least all the reports out to the public at large, and those who are on your committee, or those who are members of your organisation, who are going to be invited to come to that AGM. You need to get all the papers out, and that includes the treasurer's report, and of course, with that, obviously, would be the budget. So, I mean, so there was a mass failing on that. I'm just taking a diversion on this tangent here because it's still outstanding. I mean, we've got a parliament that needs to resume by the end of the month. In August, but there's no budget. I mean, if you liken this to the corporate world, they'd be saying, well, you're trading insolvent. They'd send the auditors in and they'd clean you out. Why has this not happened? And this is the federal parliament.
Well, first of all, Sharon, that with the ABS and the IBM, it's a $9.6 million contract, apparently. Now, that was not part of the normally annual expenditure of the ABS, so it cannot be that could be part of the budget because it's a month off to test. There should have been a special appropriation bill for that. Now, I read a statement yesterday from Malcolm Turnbull, an official writing to the Governor-General, saying that there were three budgets documents were passed by the Parliament to fund the initial. Now, I was doing my research yesterday also, and it's clear that the Frenzons Constitution, that budgets for departments must be annual. Now, annual means that if you pass the budget, you cannot change it because it has to be for the whole of the year. And I've said it in the past also in my books that I published under the Inspector Carty trademark. So, in other words, any budget papers must be regarding the departments for the entire year, not for a couple of months or not for just a few weeks. So if the budget paper, if there was a budget passed at all, for temporary, as I understood was indicated by Malcolm Turnbull, then that would be invalid because they can't change it. So then the government will run out of money because it's locked in for the whole year. And the fact that Malcolm Turnbull wants to do it for a few months cannot change the constitution and the legal principles embedded in the constitution. I obviously have a concern also that we spent $9.6 million on in a hurry onto a system that obviously if there wasn't a census 5 years ago, they had 5 years to prepare for it. So why do we suddenly have this rush to try to get a census done in such a short period which is not properly tested? Now, if I may just go on that there are people who are very worried about not having filled in the census. Some of them were doing it on the internet, some of them didn't get the mail. Now, to me, there is no violation of any laws if you didn't fill in the census, because the legislation, as I read it, was that the chief statistician, he has to ask you to fill it in. So until he actually requests you personally to fill it in, and if you can refuse, then it could be a matter for the courts, but not before that. The governments have installed, of course, all those systems like infringement notices, which we may refer to later, but that is merely to get around the legal issues. But I indicated to people that, look, if you went on the internet and the ABS cut you off, then they cannot take you to court for it because they cut you off from filling in your form.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's big guns flying everywhere here. I mean, with the Prime Minister coming out and denying any responsibility, but and that was for the disgusting management of the census that just took place. So he's not denying any responsibility. He's trying to blame it on the ABS as well as on IBM. But both of them and all of them are government. Well, they work to the government. IBM is a private outside organisation. That becomes another concern because, privatisation we're seeing is an absolute failure, and is really backfiring really on the on those that are democratically elected. I think it was a big part of this election, as well as it was a big component and topic within the state of Queensland's election too, that saw Palaszczuk of the ALP and her party brought to power. Predominantly on the privatisation issue here. So, Kelvin, so we're seeing that here, Mr. Turnbull and his trust of and use of the IBM and also to the ABS to try and defuse the issue so that he didn't carry too much flack and mud. I think it's an attempt to squash it and to silence the issue to do with the census. I think it still rages with the public. I mean, it's a government like Mr. Turnbull to have just got into government, just been re-elected. I mean, to see that the census was such a ramshackle mess, dreadful management, as you have also indicated, was a bad way to start the year. But everyone's been read the Riot Act by Mr. Turnbull, who's attempting to really suppress free speech and people's opinion on the matter. And that's various layers of the media as well as the public at large, to be able to make some kind of evaluation or criticism of the situation so that we can say we need to have a foolproof system and a system that works more for the public and the people. So we're seeing many elements of this come to light now by Mr. Turnbull. So, I mean, obviously it's going to, it's early days. It's going to be wearing, obviously, in the polls. They've got the election at the end of the month. They have promised that the Turnbull government that they're going to have an inquiry into the cyber attack that was external from Australia into Australia's system that proved that there was it was insufficient, it was negative. We've got the ABS claiming that they switched it off. Now we've got the public now being threatened with if you don't fill it in, you're going to be fined. And then we've got also to Mr. Turnbull's turned the gun on his politicians. That's his co-elected in as parliamentarians leaders or from the public at large. He's pulling the gun on them, saying that they'll be charged as well. I mean, that's Mr. Xenophon. That's also three members of the Greens Party. Jackie Lambie from Tasmania, for example, all those that have not filled it out because they've got questions unanswered. He's saying, well, if you don't, I'm going to fine you. I mean, I'm coming at you. This of course, I mean, is that of concern to you? I mean, there's multiple elements here, but I mean, the census is an indicator, isn't it, of a ramshackle government?
Well, the thing is, first of all, with Xenophon and some others, they're making a big play of it, but all they're saying is they're not putting in their name, their identity. They're not saying they're not filling in the form, and so they're just trying to attract a lot of attention to themselves for basically nothing. What the issue is this, right? And I made it clear 5 years ago when I refused to fill it in because it refers to religion. I made clear that by section 116 of the Constitution, it is unconstitutional for the Commonwealth to ask you about your religion. Whether it's voluntarily or not, they shouldn't ask you in the first place. That's why we have section 116. I argued it in court 10 years ago, and I succeeded in because I was failing to vote. I was charged, 2 convictions, and the vote were overturned because I said it was unconstitutional for them to ask me about my religion or to have exclusion on basis of religion, because then if you have an exclusion on failing to, or on not having to vote because of religion, then it also applies to a non-religion. and I won on that. So I've done it to the court, and I succeeded. So the issue, therefore, is that if the census form refers to religion, then to me is unconstitutional. Now, the Commonwealth is entitled to ask a census. They're also entitled to make statistics. That was intended by the framers of the Constitution to be passed on to the Commonwealth. However, even yesterday in my extensive research, I came across to it that the framers of the Constitution never really contemplated or understood that the Commonwealth does not deal with housing and doesn't deal with certain areas. So while they transfer the powers to the Commonwealth has nothing to do with it. So the Commonwealth is therefore asking questions which are well beyond its powers. However, the Commonwealth can ask questions about family relationship because that is within its powers. But the Commonwealth cannot, as I indicated, regarding religion or education. Now, education is simply what the Commonwealth later on introduced into the census and some other questions, just to be nosy. And that is very dangerous because if the Commonwealth was to link up, which I understood from different reports, to with Centrelink and with and other items like, you know, your passport and whatever. Now, suppose you've got a person called Joe Smith, and then you've got probably 100 Joe Smith in Australia, and if one of them get a criminal conviction, and in error they put it on the record of a different Joe Smith, then that person could be denied to leave Australia, or to come back into Australia. You could have, let's say, have that Joe Smith has a certain medical condition. They put it on the Medicare card from the ABS and or health system, and then when Joe Smith goes into hospital, then unbeknown to him, they have the wrong medical information on this card. That's very dangerous. And we got this Freedom of Information Act, which says, well, you know, you can't get your, you know, access unless you apply for it. Well, how many times do you have to apply under the Freedom of Information Act to check your own records? It costs you money. It costs your life. They're going to decide. And the government can willy-nilly get access to your records, but you have to pay for it to correct it. That's nonsense. So I have a serious problem with those issues with the census and the statistics and the usage of it. And if, in fact, the ABS is privatized, then it's even further because we know ourselves what happened with Telstra, Commonwealth Bank, when they were privatized. All the information goes overseas, like India and everything else. So those people in India are not limited by our privacy laws. They can do whatever, and they are doing that. They are selling all your details, bank details, everything else, and that's what people are getting scammed because the details are easily available overseas because our laws can only apply within Australia itself. So we have to be very careful that we should make sure that if you want to fill in the census form, which by all means that is your right whether you want to do it or not, but that you are careful, you don't give details or disclose details that could be very vital to your safety and security. I'll give you an example. When I was robbed 12 years ago, somebody went in my house, stole my wallet with all my cards. I went to a bank, which I had never been before, and I said, look, they stole my card. They said, what's your name? I gave it. What's your date of birth? I gave it. So they issued me completely with new cards. All I had to do was give my name and my date of birth. And I got, just like that, brand new documents over to, you know, my account cards from the bank. Now, to me, this is absurd. That is the danger we are having when there is so much information going out there and the ABS. And while they say, well, it's on Facebook, that's different. You don't put that amount of information on Facebook as is now available if you do it on the census. The census goes well beyond the normal requirements, in my view, as to what the government needs as to planning.
Yes, indeed.
And just quickly, since when is the federal government using housing details, statistics, for providing houses? They don't even do it for the refugees because they leave it up to the states.
Yes, precisely. So, I mean, that's a state responsibility. In other words, they're asking for information that really is irrelevant in that regard. And as you said, I mean, it's a state responsibility, and therefore it's not required. I mean, so it more or less it has a very strong message, and that is they seem to be in a chamois mess. Their management of this issue has been a shambles, and they were, on the run trying to prepare not just the election, but also to, we're seeing that the census of 2016. But another point to add to this too, is Gerrit, that the concern that was raised by Bill McLennan, he was the former Australian statistician that was headed up the ABS and headed up, of course, the census. And Bill McLennan said that this census is the most significant invasion of privacy ever perpetrated on Australians by the ABS. Now, I think there's a big warning in that by the public at large, and particularly as you've outlined as well, the stealing of people's identity and all their details. So that's a very important one. I might just add quickly, Kate Lane, who's also the vice chair of the Australian Privacy Foundation, said that that the issue, not the ABS security system, is not the issue. She's saying it was that there was no justification for tracking or personally identifying Australians. Well, I mean, do we not have two classical examples? I mean, what are we under? What is Turnbull doing here?
Sharon, my concern with AGOE is that so far the evidence is it was totally incompetent regarding the weapons of mass destruction, right? Now, putting more money to an incompetent organization is not going to fix it. And ASIO was set up by the late Menzies, who was then Prime Minister, on the request of the USA, Ronald Reagan, to have a spy agency. And what were they doing? They were preventing teachers to have jobs and everything else. That had nothing to do with national security. They were just simply interfering. Now, if you're going to provide all that information to ASIO, and ASIO put it in the wrong files, and they will say, well, national security, you're not allowed to know it. You may travel overseas, you'll not come back into Australia, and they will say, no, you can't come back in Australia. And we can't disclose to you under national security. Then you've got to take your lawyers, go to court, and the lawyers then be told by the judge, well, look, I looked at the details, and I think that ASIO has a case. But the judge doesn't know that the details that the ASIO is providing doesn't belong to you, but belongs to a stranger. But by mistake, they put it on your record. Yeah. This is the nonsense we are having. That's why it's so dangerous. Yeah. We have privacy laws which fail to be privacy laws. Because, as I indicated before, with the FOI, the Freedom of Information, you don't know what they put on your record. You don't know what they put on yours or on your Medicare card and everything else. Unless you go through all the expenses, but you could do today a query and then find out it is wrong. But even if you find out it's right today, but then tomorrow or later on today, they can do it wrongly. Now, I'll give you an example. I did, for the first time ever, I requested Freak Roads in Victoria to give me a statement as to my records regarding fines and everything else. And to my horror, I found out there was a conviction on there, which I never knew of. There was, there was their doubling of points. So, in other words, if I had lost 1 point for an offence, it showed twice the same item. Now, I found out now, 20 years later or 25 years later, so it's too late, the point, I never lost my license anyhow. But the point is this is the problem we are having when they do something wrong on your record. You don't know. You're not going to ask it every day. You're not going to spend money every day to ask for an update for your record held by them. And they don't notify you. They should notify you if they change your record and say, look, you can object to it. And this is what we are planning to put on your record. That would be a more fairer system. But on the moment, with ASIO, I would not trust them for the living daylights. To me, they should be abandoned totally. And if you want to have an agency, a security agency, start afresh with complete different people, competent people who are properly trained, but not one that plants a nation into war like Iraq on basis of weapons of mass destruction.
Well, and, I mean, also to the track record, particularly by the Liberal National Conservative government here, is border security, border protection. Here we're talking about, you know, lack of, well, overzealous government, a dictatorial style government here getting into surveillance, moving from just some primitive data that was given in now into something that's a lot more grotesque. It's morphed into this monster, so to speak, that now is invasive of the public and the people, and then handing the data and the detail on to, as you're saying, ASIO and the like, that can easily misconstrue your stuff, your data and your detail, and as you said, I mean, then you could end up in some disgusting type situation. So the people are less trusting, and we have every right. So we're reeling in, really, on this. So the public have voted with their feet. They voted in the election, the 2016 election. We found that 1.4 million people didn't vote. I mean, that's people saying, well, we haven't got confidence in this electoral process and electoral system, and that should be ringing loud bells and neon signs for politicians now that we'll be resuming back to Parliament and now that they've been democratically elected, and also to the tax office as well. The tax office is screaming about attempting to rake in the tax, but they've let the big multinational corporations be able to truck off billions of dollars offshore, you know, to tax havens like Panama, for example, and yet for common Australians to really sweat here under the weight and burden of bigger tax. And we see this divide consequently between the rich and the poor here in Australia. So, you know, we're seeing that that it is becoming a border protection, public protection, our freedoms and liberties protection is being, it's on the slaughter box, really. The chopping block by this government, the Turnbull government. So here, Gerrit, I mean, big concern, but we're heading back to Parliament at the end of the month. Now, I mean, obviously the census should be a priority issue that should be open for discussion. Instead, Mr Turnbull's threatening his co-colleague democratically elected representatives, but he's assuming that he's in charge of them, that he's more prominent and more elite than they are. You know, is he not assuming a dictatorial role here? He should be prepared to put the census on the table there in Parliament itself and start to evaluate all the concerns that have come out of this ramshackle management by Mr Turnbull and IBM and ABS. And he should, but he's not adopting that position. He's adopting himself as almost a dictator, dictating down upon people. He has no such position, does he not, according to the Constitution?
Well, first of all, Malcolm Turnbull, as the Prime Minister, should be held accountable for the huge, big failure of the ABS, of the census. He is the one in charge there. He's called Prime Minister. Now, if he cannot manage to organise something like that and have it properly tested, in particular when he used to run Osmail and everything else, and then I think he is the wrong man. It's one thing wanted to be Prime Minister, it's a second thing to be Prime Minister. You know, a competent Prime Minister. And I think, you know, so far, I don't have the impression that he is a competent Prime Minister. So we have a major problem then. He should have resigned on the fiasco. Now, another thing is that the ABS used to do it once every 10 years. You know, and now they went to once every 5 years. I see no reason why they have to do it once every 5 years. You know, so even if this census turn out to be a total failure, they can just skip it. And they should go reverse back to 10 years, you know, because that's good enough. One of the things is that the census is, once of all, it's two different type of things. One is a census for counting the number of people so that they know how many members of parliament come from every different state. So that's what the census is for about. Then you have also the statistics. And the statistics is to work out the demography of the people, you know, how it moves about, what happened, how many people die, how many people come into Australia, besides the records that they have, because a lot of people come illegally into Australia and everything else. So the births and deaths and everything else. What is amazing really is that births and deaths is still done by the state government, whereas the federal government has about marriage and everything else. You would think now that birth and death would be part of the federal government and have that registration. Then they have automatically all the details. They don't have to ask then regarding a census form to have about your would be automatically recorded. Now, the reason is, of course, that the birth and death laws, because what happened is that constitutionally, when you are born in a state, you automatically have then the right of franchise when you come on the right age. So if you turn 18 in Victoria, or 16, I think, in Western Australia, you then have a right to vote. Now, that clearly is a state matter, but what happened is that unconstitutionally, I must say, they're now saying, well, the Commonwealth decides whether you have a right to vote, whether you have, and in 2006, when I had that court case, the Attorney General then admitted that the state of Victoria do not have any laws regarding citizenship. Now, citizenship is not, Australian citizenship, people misunderstand it, it's not a nationality. Constitutionally, you have state citizenship, which is your right to vote. That's it. Not your nationality, it's a right to vote. And then automatically, if you get a state citizenship, you get out Australian citizenship, which is your right to vote in federal parliament if you are at an adult age. Now, the adult age is whatever the federal government decides it is. If it's 21, it's 21, then they change to 18. If they want to change it to 16, they can change it to 16. But you must have, first of all, the right to vote in federal election. That's section 41 of the Constitution. So that's what citizenship is about. What they have done, the federal government, they have hijacked it. And they now say, well, citizenship is your nationality. It's no such thing. I published a book about it, and as I indicated, in 2003, I published the Inspector Ricciardi on Citizenship, and that sets it out in great detail.
Yes, indeed. So, I mean, we need to get the data, and we need to also keep them on track. We're seeing that what's become evident here in this entire mismanagement and schmozzle by the Turnbull government on the census issue has been that it's morphed into another different shape with a lot more intensity, and that obviously the technology has been able to advance a deeper probe, and it's now becoming surveillance upon the Australian public. This is where we have a right to our liberties and our freedoms, and we have a and obviously the public are wanting to assert this, and we've seen that as much as 1.4 million people did not tie themselves or vote within the federal election. I'm sure that with this census as well, we're probably going to see a lot more people, millions more, actually not participating in the census. So it's going to be a futile type census. But again, too, I mean, they do cross-pollinate with other systems. So systems of information and data is all there. And it brings us into another topic and situation, and that is, are they not holding too much information on us? And university students now are coming under the torch as well and are being mapped by technology, and that again is a big concern by the federal government in probing and surveillance upon university students, which they say is for educational purposes, but actually it's not educational purposes. The belief is that it's more for civil and political control of the public at large. So it's moving into surveillance, it's moving into population control, it's moving into anti-civil and political rights rights of the population at large, and it questions the whole basis of democracy, but also to the intrusion and the greater build-up, it appears, within our structures of fascism and dictatorship, as we're seeing that the power of the many is now being shrunk into the power of the few, and we're seeing this top-down, push-down approach by government, the pushing around of the public by, and threatening of the public by leadership, in this case Mr. Turnbull himself, and we're seeing a lot more concealment and secrecy as well. These are all hallmarks of that which is dictatorship. So my question still stands here, though, Gerrit, and that is Mr. Turnbull threatening his own colleagues and politicians with possible jail and fines, on this census issue, when very clearly they are democratically elected representatives in the parliament. Can he jail other politicians? This is a big issue. Would it not be, this is a loud bell ringing. He should be obviously saying, look, I mean, obviously there's concerns by my colleagues. They are democratically elected. I need to take this to parliament. I need to not just have an investigation. I need to lay this on the table. I need to open up for discussion. And we need to obviously look at where the fault lay in this census, and we need to look at how we improve it. How do we take out all the surveillance out of it, and how do we make it just a common, simple, as it was, census? So, Gerard, on that matter, are we not concerned about the fact that Mr. Turnbull has turned upon and asserted himself over and above all other politicians here in a dictatorial role?
Well, as a Prime Minister, right, his function is to try to lead the government on behalf of the Governor General, because really the Governor General is the head of the government. And the Governor General then accepts the advice of the ministers normally, except like in war and everything else. Now, that's the position the Prime Minister has. He has no power technically to sack any minister. Well, by convention, they may let him do that, but constitutionally, he has no such power. He has no power to imprison anyone. In fact, when this Bishop case came with the helicopter issue, Tony Abbott was asked to do something about Julie Bishop. But the point was, he has no power in the Parliament because the Parliament, the House of Reps, was under Bronwyn Bishop. She is the head of that, and Tony Abbott was merely a member of the Parliament, so he could not do anything against her. So the same with Turnbull. He has no power other than what he is permitted by the Constitution as the Prime Minister, which is just simply like a minister. And he cannot imprison anyone. What he can do is to seek the federal police, let's say, to investigate matters. And then the courts, they can only imprison people. That's our system that we have that's embedded in our constitution. So Turnbull, if he makes any claims that he can do something against another person, he would be dead wrong in that, and he should be better known about that too. Regretfully, what we have is that basically, when you join Parliament, you become a member of the Millionaires Club. Now and yet, no matter what rotten job you are doing, you will end up like a multimillionaire when you leave. That is how cozy they made it. That's why it's so hard for the ordinary person to either get into the Parliament because of that. And I think we have to change that system. We need to make it that, you know, it becomes less financially attractive to be a member of Parliament, so that we may have plenty of retired people or retired from the workforce who'll be glad to go into the Parliament, who have the lifetime experience to know what to put into the Parliament, who do not go in there for a cozy job, but who are willing to actually present to the people what they have learned themselves is required. That's what I like to see from the Parliament.
Yes, indeed. We're seeing that, I mean, even with the case study that came out of New South Wales just recently, we're seeing that lobbyists, professional lobbyists inside the Parliament, now we're seeing inside the Liberal Party, are actually lobbyists. They also belong to firms and companies and corporations and organisations. That's actually what their lobby force interest sits on, and that is to advance those corporations' interests inside our Parliament. But they're also now entering into the Liberal Party. They're acting as warlords and controlling who gets up in pre-selection as a candidate and to sit within the Liberal Party. So whilst they were very critical of the Labor Party and the union members and people actually operating in this way, here we see, and I think it regards the ALP, I mean, it was always seen to be day one. It was created as a union organisation to represent the public and represent the people and represent the workers. But here we're seeing the Liberal Party actually doesn't represent any of that. It's hard to really know what they actually represent. I think they just represent the rich end of town, the blue set rents, those from Toorak, and the rich getting richer, and just for profit type systems that's going to advance their wealth. So we're seeing here that these warlords are sitting there to access, give a green light to, and we're seeing the big concern, and particularly in this article that came out of the Australian newspaper on the 10th of August, with Mr. Photios and Campbell, who are inside moles inside the Liberal Party that have got conflict of interest in wearing hats Gerrit, of hats of inside the political party and the administration of it, as well as inside of the corporation world, but bringing in candidates who will represent the corporation policies. Now, this is where we get the big concern, because the battle from 2014 on, and especially, has been around the fact that we need to have public policies put forth in our parliament and not corporation policies. And we saw there the from 2014 on, and Tony Abbott, we saw the 2014 budget, which was knocked together by the Business Council of Australia, having their fingerprints all over it, and being rejected by the Australian public and rejected by our Senate, and therefore, of course, it became the target of Mr. Turnbull to burst the Senate at the top and to toss everyone into a double dissolution, which he lost badly. It was a huge embarrassment. It's backfired, and he's lucky just to be there only by one, but perhaps by a contravention of the Sale of Office Act, with a rough deal stitched up in secrecy with the National Party. So, let's look at it. Garrett, again, too, this is how it's occurring. This is how they're filling it and topping it up with anti-public, anti-democracy representatives, and those that are, trying to tip the wealth of our democracy into the pockets of the rich. But this can be easily turned off. They're attempting to do that in New South Wales, and they've subjected this process to an inquiry. These two lobbyists, for example, they've subjected to an inquiry, and the Australian Electoral Commission is onto it at the moment. But we need to make these systems work, do we not, for the public at large, whether it be the census, the Australian Electoral Commission. We need to eradicate privatisation and burn the contracts up. It's working against our democracy. We're seeing that our cost of living and life and poverty is increasing enormously, and we're going down the gurgler by the looks steadily. The census is a big indicator, is it not, that all is not well. But here we've got the public fighting back, enormous fight back, is there not, and it will continue to be. But also with some of these laws that they're bringing out, they're ultra vires, are they not here? Because the census having morphed into this other beast of an animal of some sort, the content is too probing and too bursting of our civil rights here. Garrett, it's morphed into these ultra-virus laws, laws as well as what we're seeing are policies, and even practices are almost ultra-virus. Ultra-virus because it sits outside the Constitution. If it's ultra-virus, then the public have no right to obey. Then the public have a right to vote with their feet. They have a right to say, well, I'm not going to comply with this. They have a right to say no. They have a right to protest. They have a right to boycott. And they have a right of no cooperation with this, with these systems that Mr. Turnbull or whoever would want to try to impose top-down upon us. This is a battleground, is it not? But we do have rights here. We can just easily withdraw, as Mahatma Gandhi did with the Indians and their populations when Britain attempted to take over that nation here, Garrett. Okay. Again, too, it was no cooperation was what the Indians applied. It is the very method by which this system can be pulled down by the public at large and the public gain their powers back. Is this not the case?
Yeah. You refer to quite a few issues. First, quickly, with the census, that's been in process for thousands of years. They used to do it applied to poll tax, and the census in itself was legitimate the way it was used then. Now, however, there are privacy concerns because of the way our system is, the computer system, and how it's being used, not to advance governance, but rather how it advances the invasion of privacy against the people. That's where the problem is. When we come, for instance, to the political donations, which is another issue you raised, by corporations, to me, any corporation that provides a political donation should be banned automatically for 10 years of being able to be involved in government contracts. So, in other words, if we had with John Howard that he was getting funding, as I understood it, for ethanol companies and then ethanol companies, and then the moment he was then elected, he provided millions of dollars to the ethanol companies. Now, to me, that is where there is a conflict of interest there. And so I would like to see a minimum 10-year ban to any company having a government contract if they made a political donation. The thing is also, there should be a limit of a donation. I like to see a limit of $1,000. Now, it's mostly to say you need money to advertise because there are people who are getting elected sometimes which have no big budget at all, so the advertising doesn't depend on it. When we now get to your other point about being ultra-virus, the famous Costi debated it at length, and let me say this right. So the government has the power whether those laws are within a constitutional context is, of course, different. I mean, if the state parliament from Victoria wants to pass a law that fish are only allowed to swim for 10 kilometres, now, it would be a nonsense of law. No fish would listen to it, and it would be nonsense because it's not within the powers normally. But they can pass it. Well, they were crazy. This is the same with other laws. So what we had in the Wakeham case, which was decided by the High Court in High Court of Australia, HCA 27 of 1999, the High Court said that Mr. Gould, who was then a person subject to a court order, he could ignore the court orders because they were unconstitutional. What I could make clear is this. If a law or if a court order is unconstitutional, you can disregard it. Of course, it's better if you have a court order in your favour that it is unconstitutional, but sometimes you can't manage it. This is why when I'm in the court, I first of all go to laws that are unconstitutional, like the Infringement Act. I said it was unconstitutional, and I explained why. And the judge did not make an order against me for an infringement notice about nearly $1,500 because he knew, he realized I was right on the constitutional matters. So what happened is this. You've got a lot of laws in force. You've got the infringement court in AEO does, and you've got speed cameras from, let's say, from Victoria, whereas as I done another research this week about the weight and measure, which is clearly within the federal government powers, and the state has no legislative power, so they cannot certify for speed cameras in Victoria. Yet they're using them to convict you of speeding. Now, I don't promote speeding, but I am saying that people should understand that laws that are outside the legislative powers of a state cannot be enforced, the same as laws that are outside the legislative powers of the Commonwealth cannot be enforced. They will do it. They will use this crooked system of infringement system to get court orders against you, which you haven't got a clue about sometimes. That happens. But the point is this. The moment you go to court, the moment you say, look, that is unconstitutional, it is then for the accuser, the prosecutor, to prove it's constitutionally valid. You don't have to disprove the that it's not constitutionally valid. They have to prove it's constitutionally valid. That's the difference. Because I'm a person who researches all that stuff, I stand up in court and do that very successfully. But regretfully, you can end up in court not knowing all your rights, and then you will get court orders against you. If then you find, however, that afterwards you say, hey, moment, I was in the right after all, the judge was wrong, and you ignore those court orders, then they could take it to court for ignoring the court orders. But if you then say, well, look, those court orders were unconstitutional because they are out of RS, you know, then, of course, there is nothing they can do against you because you can still win your case afterwards. But it's a dangerous step to do, right? And you can go to lawyers, and lawyers only give their legal opinion because plenty of lawyers go to court for parties and they lose the case. So don't think that lawyers know everything about it. I just like people to be aware that there are laws, like privacy laws and everything else, but they give the government powers to access your information freely. They're not giving you more rights. That is the misconception of a lot of people, that they think that they get therefore more rights. They're not. It's only saying that the government and any government department, that means any private corporation working with the government, they can get all your details. And that's the danger, because with the ABS, the census, if they get now all that information about you, you are subject to or likely subject to identity theft on a grand scale.
Yes, indeed. So, I mean, we're saying it's all risky, and of course, the people need, government needs to have the confidence of the people. And obviously, Mr. Turnbull, on this issue to do with the census, I mean, he should be taking it back to Parliament. He should be discussing it openly with at Parliament itself. And instead of acting like a dictator, that he's going to threaten people with jail and imprisonment. As you said, he cannot do that. But any ultra-virus laws, this is a big role for the public at large, and that is if these laws are seen to be outside of law, set outside of law itself, outside of the jurisdiction of law, whatever layer it is, then the public have a right of non-cooperation. They have a right to even boycott it and strike and protest. This is a very strong element, and conscientious objection as well here, Garrett, because, you know, again, People have a right here. The public have an enormous right and have an enormous power if they would wield the power and wield their rights and target their rights, and that courts need to listen to the public at large, because the public are the centrepiece to the Constitution, not the Parliament, not the Prime Minister, not, parliamentarians that we elect, but they are there to represent the will of the people in their electorate. So we need to make sure that these pro-public policies are getting up and not pro-business and pro the top end of town, pro the rich, pro the BRW rich list. This is where we where the battle line has been drawn. But ultra-virus, obviously, and protest, so therefore it gets back to as well, the governments can't crack down as they've been appearing to do upon the public at large should they protest. This is also enshrined, this ultra-virus element of the law is also enshrined in our civil and political rights at the United Nations level, and that also Australia was a signatory to that document, even though they may not have articulated a law here in this country. At the same time too, we're seeing here, Garrett, that of course the Australia Act is a false act. The Colonial Act Act as well is a colonial act which obviously opens up the door to all the laws of England. And it was in 86 an attempt by the Hawke government at the time, and also to the Fraser government, to attempt to bring in a false Australia Act, giving Australia a false sovereignty based upon a false report by the Parliament at the time of a referendum in 1984, which is equalisations of powers, Garrett. And we're seeing that those falsities was there to attempt to deny the public and the people all of our rights that are enshrined in all the laws of England, which includes our human rights, all of our civil and political rights, all rights. So they're certainly enshrined there. They're also protected. So the more that we know these rights, and we're seeing that as from that time of Hawke's time in government, and how Fraser was also actively involved, we're seeing here, Garrett, that that act, the Australia Act, obviously we're seeing that there's an attempt to try and shrink down the rights of the public, take our liberties and our freedoms, bring in anti-association laws as well. And, you know, we're seeing that martial law, if you look at and study Mahatma Gandhi's life and what happened there in India, that through the protest and through their non-cooperation with the British government at the time over the salt tax, and the salt tax to be imposed, which was a cruel tax upon the mass majority of the public and the people who were mainly Indian, and it was robbing them. But people had non-participation in Britain and its laws. The laws can only work if people participate in the system. If you don't participate, which the Indian people under the leadership of Mahatma Gandhi decided to do, then those laws cannot work. And then that ended up ultimately with Britain exiting out of India, and a mass victory to the Indian people, and of course the establishment of independence there in India for the public and for the people. So, you know, the way to deal with dictatorships as well is to, you know, non-cooperation with them and with their laws, because most of them are ultra-virus and sit outside of our constitution, as well as unilateral declaration of independence laws, which is also how under Tito in Yugoslavia and his dictatorship, that the people there divided into five states in order to be able to escape the dictatorship and the rule there at the time, and they became Bosnia, Serbia, Croatia, etc., and all those other five states. So obviously people will look for escapes, look for the way out when dictatorship and when oppression starts to occur. But there's got to be a fight here, and that's the point, the fight. So the fight continues, does it not?
Yeah, can I say something? That is this. I'm going to use a metaphor, right? Suppose now you have a motor vehicle, and then you've got four children, and you tell your children, well, you can combine yourself, and then you look after the car, you can use it in between of yours. Would you then say that after 1 or 2 years that they were using the motor vehicle, your car, that's registering your name, they suddenly become the owner of the vehicle? You would say absolutely not, because you're still legally the owner. Well, that's the same with our constitution. Our constitution was created. It was approved by the people of colonies. We then vote in referendums. We change the referendum, sorry, the constitution, by successful referendums. I am not aware, and probably none of our listeners is aware, of any amendment to the constitution that allows the governments of the states to change the constitution. Now, that's what it is. Now, much is being said about the Constitution, Section 5737, that the states can give powers to the Commonwealth to, make agreements with Great Britain. And that is apparently what the Harcourt claims was the Australian Act 1986, that within that power. But no, it says the Constitution refers to the states. The states are the people. And as the framers of the Constitution made clear, it's the people by state election that has to vote whether or not they want to make changes. Now, I'm not aware, therefore, that there was any election, any referendum, state referendum, in the state of Victoria, let alone in other states either, that gave the government or the Parliament of Victoria the power to authorize such an amendment to the Constitution that people who were British subjects suddenly became citizens of the Queen of Australia. I know of no such referendum, and no lawyer yet has, no government official has yet shown to me this to have happened. And as I referred to earlier, I published a book, Inspector Cardio Citizenship, in 2003, and I extensively canvassed that issue. Wood Barton was saying, Edmund Barton, he was the first Prime Minister of Australia, and he made clear, with the creation of the Constitution before that, we are all alike subjects of the British Crown. Now, I'm not aware that anything like that has changed. There was no referendum to change it. This is the problem we are having. We have now courts that paid homage to the government, and the government who now put itself above the rule of law, and then we have a parliament who now abides by the demands of the government rather than the other way around. Because the government ordinary can only operate within the rules of law from the parliament allows it to do. But that's no longer existing. This is the problem we are having. We have everything being privatized but the government itself. If we were to put politicians on wages that they have to perform, they would all of them probably be sacked immediately. I used to be in management of factories. I used to hire and fire people. And I tell you this, I haven't seen a politician yet earning his upkeep in to be in Parliament. So let's be clear about this. The Australian Act 1986 is, in my view, as a constitutionalist, not within the powers of the state government to have authorised that. And the Constitution only provides for the federal parliament to accept a referral like that. But if the referral itself was unconstitutional, then the federal parliament had no powers. That is the critical point, and even the current Chief Justice himself, Frentz, from the High Court of Australia, when he was judge of the court in Western Australia, he himself wrote about Section 51, and he himself indicated Section 51 does not give powers to any state. It merely gives the powers to the Commonwealth to accept items. So we have to go back to our constitution in the states, which we have an invalid 1975 Victorian Constitution Act. And if we look at that, so we have a serious problem with the High Court because we've got the judges who are not going by the rule of law, but rather make up their own mind how to amend or how to corrupt or how to undermine our constitution. And to me, that's a very serious matter.
Yes, it is. It's a very serious matter. And, of course, it's getting greater exposure, of course, by the public and the people at large. And we're seeing, again, too, laws and policies as well as processes of government attempting to be used and abused out of the democratic framework. And now we're seeing a polarisation of power and the big concern with dictatorship in our midst, the top-down, push-down approach. attempting to come into our parliament and into our governance as a whole, right across the board, and it does have detrimental impact and it does have detrimental effect upon the public at large. The public will be the losers, but this is where the battle line has been drawn, especially since 2014. We've seen some mass pushback, and I'm sure in 2016 we're going to continue to see even greater pushback, and I'm certain that there's been pushback in the election itself, with people voting with their feet, non-cooperation in that, as well as non-cooperation in the census, and I'm seeing that, obviously there's going to be a range of other issues as we look at the budget, and we haven't really got to the bottom of and resolved the issue of Sale of Office Act, and its application as well, and its impact upon Parliament itself and representatives that have been democratically elected. Garrett, there's been a lot we've discussed. I want to thank you very much indeed for joining me today. The issues have been enormous, really. They've got enormous impact for the future for us as all Australians. And I want to thank you very much indeed for your contribution.
Well, I hope that people who have listened into our interview and our conversation, that they are more concerned about their privacy and what it stands about, and their rights, and by all means, if they want to write to me and they put in the subject matter constitution, I have every intention of writing back to them. I had recently a guy who was facing a court case. I didn't get involved in all his details. I simply saw that the court order was supposed to be withdrawn and dismissed. And I just wrote to him, well, you can't have both. You can't have withdrawn and dismissed. It's either one of them. So when they reinstituted a court case against him, he used that, and immediately the case got withdrawn because it was invalid. This is how sometimes people ask my help, and I assist them, and I don't charge for it. But I'm retired now, so I try to minimise it because I try to go on to constitutional issues only. But people should be understanding that they need to get active into constitutional matters. They need to read the constitution and then see what their rights are, and then challenge the authorities on anything that they feel is unconstitutional. It's only by that way that they become a sentry to protect it, because if they ignore it, then consider their children and their grandchildren, everything else, they will lose out because they themselves did not, in the first place, stand up for their rights. Well, and I'd like to thank everybody for listening in and for having me.
Yes, and if they're ultra-virus laws, which is outside of the Constitution, which many of them are, then they are no laws to be obeyed. Therefore, the public have every right to no cooperation with those laws, as well as protest and boycott. But thank you very much indeed for being with me today, Gary.
And thank you, Sharon, for having me, and thank you for the listeners to listen to us.